Welcome to the College Admissions Process Podcast presented by Prep Expert. Prep Expert offers live online SAT and ACT courses with the best score guarantees, instructors, and curriculum. Go to prepexpert.com to guarantee your child's success. Welcome to the CAP, the College Admissions Process Podcast. I am your host, John Durante, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you today Robert Franek, who's the editor-in-chief at the Princeton Review. He's also their expert on education and anything and everything college-related. I met Rob down at the NACAC conference. That's the National Association for College Admissions Counseling. Now, I saw Rob in action in this booth, which must have been about 2,000 square feet. And there he was talking to private counselors, public school counselors, parents, and he was such a natural. Rob, I am so happy to have you here today. How are you?
Oh, John, I'm really good, and it's so good to be with you, and thank you for the invitation. I'm so grateful.
Well, we appreciate that. Thank you so much, Rob. So let's get right into it. Rob, can you share a bit more about your background and role as the editor-in-chief for the Princeton Review, and how did you get involved in the field of college admissions?
That's a good question, and I appreciate it. I've been at Princeton Review for 24 and a half years, John. I can't quite believe I got this old. And
You look great, Rob.
You're nice. Thank you. But it's been wonderful. You know, I graduated college in 1993. I went to a little school in New Jersey called Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. And I loved it. And then when I was getting out of school, I used to be a tour guide at Drew all through my 4 years as an undergrad. And one of the admission folks who I befriended said, "Hey, I saw this job in the Chronicle," and it was the paper edition of the Chronicle. And it was for a school on Staten Island called Wagner College that was looking for an assistant director of admission. And they said, you should apply. I waited for them to leave wherever we were. And I ran to I got a copy of the Chronicle and I sent in my resume. And then the next day I was sitting in Staten Island and they hired me that day. And then I picked up the move. I think I was there a week later. And it was towards the end of the summer. So it was the beginning of the travel season. So my territory was Staten Island Public Schools, all the four boroughs of New York City, and then Connecticut through Maine. So I was just on the road I loved it. You know, just the idea of, and I know you talked to so many admission counselors, admission representatives, but to me, I was so suited to my personality, John, that I liked talking about one school with students, parents, and counselors. I called them the Holy Trinity in my mind. and to sell Staten Island like it was the land of Canaan, which I grew up in the Bronx. So, I mean, I didn't really know as much about Staten Island, but I fell for it so hard. And it was just such a good spot for me. And and then I moved on from there. Again in the Chronicle a couple years later, I worked at Wagner for, I guess, 5 or 6 years. And I was in grad school at the time at Pratt. And then, there was this job at Princeton Review, and it said you had to have, and was to lead their very small publishing division. You had to have five.
Not so small anymore, right?
Not so small anymore, exactly. Yeah. 5 to 6 years college admissions experience. And then the second criteria was you had to have a sense of humor. I'm like, I love these guys. And I used to teach for them when I was in college at Drew. I used to teach how to take the SAT as a tutor, but I hadn't thought about them in years. And then turns out that they hired me on the spot. I went there. I interviewed with the guy that started the company, John Katzman, who's still my dear friend. And so 24 and a half years later, I'm still kicking.
Wow, that's awesome. And they are so lucky to have you, as are we. And by the way, I grew up in Brooklyn, so I know Wagner College very well. We had Anthony at Admissions Reps on Wagner on the podcast. So a big shout out to Wagner College and all the students there. So Rob, I know that you meet with so many students and their families. What would you say are the biggest worries for college-bound students and, of course, their parents?
Oh, gosh. And these are worries, John, to me, that I would say, I want to say this just happened this year or last year. But the truth is that this has been a perennial worry. You know, we've been conducting this survey at the Princeton Review. I'll steep this in data. We've been conducting the survey. It's called College Hopes and Worries. We now have 21 years of annual data of college-bound students and their parents. You know, so students from Syosset High School, you know, might have filled out the survey, likely they did, maybe their parents as well. And we asked them, what are their biggest hopes and their biggest fears around the college process? Biggest fear, and this is now for 8 consecutive years running, is fear around assuming too much debt to pay for college. And a second is that they, you know, will get into their first choice schools, but families wouldn't be able to pay for it. So that specter of cost and navigating the financial aid process and not failing your kids if you filled out the FAFSA form incorrectly. But, you know, the truth is that it is a burden for students and parents. And I think that's why you and I hit it off so well, because if you can address things that make students worried, stress their families, you know, give them this overall fear around the college process, if you can diffuse that and say, I see you and I hear you, let's talk about this intelligently, let's serve up some granular detail so it doesn't feel so scary. Well, then now you have a willing audience, right? And now fear is subsided, and now they're ready to think about the college process with confidence. And to me, that's it. Then your audience is yours to help create and move them to a better spot.
Absolutely. And, you know, I speak to so many college reps myself, and inevitably they always talk about the importance of talking about the financial piece early and often for the points that you raise, Rob. In other words, you don't want to apply to a college to get accepted and then only to find out that you can't afford it because you didn't have that conversation early. That would be drastic for the parents, for the student, and frankly, for everybody involved. So it really is great advice. And I appreciate you sharing the College Hopes and Worries survey. And I'm not surprised that that was the number one thing, as you said, for 8 consecutive years. Another thing, Rob, as you know, that's on a lot of people's minds is the test optional admissions talk, right? How many schools are test optional? Some in California now are test blind. Rob, are submitting test scores really optional? What do you think?
Oh, that's a good question, my friend. And the thing to me, and I'm going to just say it out loud, I still teach the SAT and the ACT. They are deeply flawed exams. I don't like them, but they are still necessary in the process, as they are flawed, but they are still necessary in the process. To answer your question, I do not think that testing is actually an option, because the truth is that, you know, if students apply to the traditional amount of schools, like most students nationally will apply to between, let's call it 7 and 9 schools. And there might be some SIAC kids might be applying to 10 or 11, who knows, but somewhere between 7 and 9 is the national average, right? But when we think about it, if you're applying to all schools in California and they're UCs or Cal States, well then yes, there are test blind or test free. You'll never need the SAT or ACT for academic admission. But that still accounts for about, let's call it 9% of schools in the whole country are actually test free or test blind. The vast majority are test optional, whether permanently, or the mass majority are temporarily test optional, still 4 years into the pandemic, right? And the truth is that if a school, because they are test optional, John, may not penalize a student for not submitting the score, but they may consider your SAT and ACT scores if you submit them. So to me, I tell all of my students, you know, like, take the tests. If you scored well above the 50% mean that the school is reporting, then send them in. Why wouldn't you? And then if you fall below it, right? I mean, you give the same advice. If you fall below it, then withhold your scores. Exercise your test optional right to withhold them.
But absolutely. The
truth is, if you don't do it, then you're going to get hobbled because, you know, ROTC requires the SAT or ACT. So many schools that have academic scholarships or other scholarship requirements, many of them are the SAT or an ACT. So I'm like, how could you not think about the importance of those flawed exams? But the truth is they are valuable in the process, not only for academic admission, but in large part for scholarship dollars as well. I'm yapping on here, but you totally get this.
No, I totally get it. And I totally agree with you. And the one thing that I want to add is just a reminder to everyone that the mid 50% range that you mentioned, okay, nowadays is skewed because those numbers are based only on the students that are submitting their test scores. So obviously the numbers are going to be higher than they were 5, 8, 10 years ago. So it's something to keep in mind. And to your point, if you're on the higher end of that mid 50 or frankly higher, and you feel, wow, this is a great representation of who I am as a student, submit it. But again, Rob, to your point, if you fall lower and you don't think that submitting that score is going to help your overall application, then you have the option not to submit in schools that are in fact test optional. The other thing that I always remind students to do is keep in mind that, for example, I think it was my conversation with the rep from Syracuse University, they're test optional. However, if you're applying to their nursing program, or I think it was engineering, you may have to submit test scores for the more competitive majors. So it's always important to check the individual colleges or universities' website for the latest and greatest information. Now, Rob, speaking of test scores, you know more than anybody that there's a new digital SAT. In fact, you have a great publication related to it. So, Rob, why did it change? And will it be easier or more difficult than that old pencil and paper test?
Yeah, the pencil and paper. Sell your stock, John, and number two pencils, if you have any. You know, so College Board, who creates the SAT and the 38 AP exams, you know, made the decision January of 2022 that the SAT was now going to tectonically change from pencil and paper to digital. And the interesting thing to me is that they could have, College Board could have said, we're going to change not only the platform, but we're also going to change the content that was going to be tested. And they chose not to. And honestly, listen, I'm not a huge College Board fan, but I will certainly give them accolades where I think it is due. And that is one of them, right? You can't, in my opinion, it's hard to introduce so much change to a student in any one given year, right? So if you're going to change the structure and the content, that's difficult. And it would be difficult for the College Board as well, because they're saying that, listen, the content is going to remain eerily the same. The platform is changing. You know, we're working, you know this more than anybody, right? The idea of all students being digital natives, right? Mm-hmm. Pencil and paper feels so old school to them. If they want that, they can do ACT, right? Really, I mean, the truth is that the College Board has said, listen, we're changing this exam. It is going to be digital. We're going to save nearly a full hour, you know, from a 3-hour exam to a 2-hour exam, really 2 hours and 14 minutes, not to split hairs. But the truth is that it's a huge saving from a testing perspective, from a teacher perspective. If you're saving a full 45 minutes that you don't have to focus, because testing fatigue, you know this, John, is a real thing. But
sure,
yeah, so it's going to be a benefit to students to take that digital exam. The only rub, the only detractor, is that it will now become an adaptive exam, which I tell all of my students now, as every Princeton Review teacher does for the pencil and paper test. You know, listen, I'm like, look, you receive no extra points, no additional points for answering the toughest question on the SAT than you do the easiest question on the SAT. So the obvious strategy is answer all the easy questions first and then spend your extra time and focus on the hard questions. But the truth is that that strategy kind of goes out the window with the digital exam, because you have that flexibility, but you only have it in the small cohort of questions for each of those sections. So now you will be attributed additional points, for the toughest questions on the SAT than you do on the easiest questions on the digital SAT. And that is the thing I just want my students to know, or students in general to know about, and their parents and counselors as well.
Well, that's great insight. And, you know, I always say that the students today, not people like you and me, Rob, that did take with the number two pencil, the pencil and paper test way back. And I'm not going to share my score with you right now, okay? But the point being is that the students today, they are natives of this thing that we call the digital language. They are really much more comfortable doing it digitally than people like us are. So I can appreciate that the SAT moved in that direction. And Rob, do you think anything will happen to the ACT as a result of the digital SAT shift?
You know, this was the talk of NACAC, and you had mentioned that National Association of College Admission Counselors.
Sure.
It was the talk of NACAC in the last conference, because the truth is that the ACT, you know, is actually, John, when you and I were looking at, so there was a myth then and it's a myth now, which was, only colleges on the left coast and the right coast of the United States honored the SAT, and every college in the Great Middle only took the ACT. And it was wrong then and it's wrong now. But the truth is that the value of the SAT and ACT from an admission perspective, like, they're interchangeable tests, right? There shouldn't be a pox on your house if you submitted an ACT rather than an SAT. It doesn't matter. But the ACT, eerily funny to me, is that right before the pandemic, at NACAC 2019, they made this big announcement that in the next academic year, by September of 2020, that the ACT was going to be an online exam. As long as you took the first full-length ACT, you could then take 1, 2, or 3 single-section retests online, and then you can increase your score in that way. which was to me a benefit, a huge benefit to students, that if you wanted to improve your ACT score, you didn't have to sit for a 3-hour exam. Now you just had to sit for the 45 minute section. And it was a coup. But then factor in a global pandemic, ACT had to pull that option, and it's never to be heard of again. Right. So ACT, if history proves true, John, two things will happen, right? When digital SAT comes in full in March of 2024, students will flock to the ACT, you know, because of the next exam in town, which I could imagine ACT is waiting to collect those dollars. Or they're going to kind of buckle down and say, hey, the digital exam, you know, College Board might be kinder on me because I'm the first Marines in with the new test, but we'll see what happens. But one of those things will happen. But ACT right now has only alluded to an online or a digital exam, but has not put anything concrete in place.
Right. And Rob, I was wondering, because during some of my conversations with admissions representatives, they reported that a student might not submit an SAT or ACT test. This is, of course, if a school is test optional, but that they might submit AP scores for consideration. Emory was one of those schools that mentioned this during my conversation with the admissions rep. So what do you think accounts for the rise in popularity in the AP test? And do you think they will replace the SAT and ACT?
This is, to me, John, the trillion-dollar question. And and you know, as we talk about, College Board owns the SAT and owns the 38 AP exams, right? And so the truth is that, and you're right, Emory and some other schools like Emory are grabbing onto this idea of test flexible, which simply means, as you noted, if a student chooses not to submit the SAT or ACT, then they may submit another exam. And obviously the best next exam will probably be an AP test. And College Board, I think, is banking on that to happen. And I think from a testing perspective, AP exams, well, you know this. I mean, AP exams are going to be testing your content knowledge of that academic discipline. Where the SAT or ACT, even in its digital incarnation, I tell all my students, the SAT doesn't test you how smart you are. It tests you how well you're taking that test. That's it. But an AP biology test is going to test you on how smart you are in biology, certainly.
Right.
A discipline-centric, you know, in that regard. So I do think that depending on how this rolls out with the digital SAT and what happens with ACT, you know, those exams still have not ratcheted back up to their pre-pandemic levels. Those tests are still not as popular. And for all the things that we've discussed, test optional being the top of the list, but AP exams have become more valuable because of that shakiness around the SAT and the ACT. And do I think it's gonna continue? Oh, 100%. But then it becomes an access and an equity question, right? Because you know, not every student has the same access to as many AP exams at one school than they would have another, or as AP classes as they would at one school than another. And that's obviously another issue, but it's a significant one, no doubt.
Yeah, it's definitely a significant one. And it's a typical question that I ask the admissions reps, which is, how do you account for one school that offers, let's say, 20 AP courses while another may only offer 5 or 6? And of course, what they always talk about is that they look at the school profile and they are reviewing the student based on what is offered in their high school and whether or not they took advantage of what was offered to them.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you mentioning that, Rob. And Rob, from your perspective, what are then the key components of a strong college application? And are there any common mistakes that applicants should avoid?
Yeah. I mean, I think finding fit, and I talk to all of my students about this, and this sounds kind of hokey a little bit, John, but when I talk to students, I talk them about finding fit. I'm like, listen, fit is four things, the way I define it. And I tell all, and I speak in a lot of high schools, most every given evening across the country, I am somewhere in a high school. And my husband, who's right off camera, he's like, oh, I never see you. You never know. But I mean, I tell all of those students and their parents, you know, listen, fit is the most important thing. As we discussed at the beginning, choosing a school incorrectly, it is an expensive venture, right? If you chose your school incorrectly, just the amount of, not only the personal angst and anguish for you and your family, but it shakes your confidence. And then you might lose some dollars as well, right? I mean, you know, from a scholarship perspective, certainly. So when I talk about fit, I talk about it so earnestly. Fit is four things. Obviously, an academic fit. You want to make sure you're engaged and challenged in the classroom. This is obvious. A campus culture fit. Maybe not so obvious to some students. So do students at that school lean to the left or right politically? Maybe that's important. Right. Maybe it's not. Are they religious at that school? Maybe that's important. Maybe it's not. does diversity exist, which you can see through plain old statistics, but do diverse students actually interact with one another? Maybe you want to know, right. You know, are queer students accepted? Are the beds comfortable? Are the food good? Like what is the food good? What are the things outside the classroom that also experience inside the classroom, but what is going to be your full experience at that school academically and otherwise? And to me, it is the trillion-dollar question. Next, financial aid fit, gotta be a fit. You said this yourself, but talk about it now, because you're gonna avoid that conversation. If you're avoiding that conversation, even though it might feel well-intentioned, it's kind of just burying our heads, whereas we should have that conversation as a family or as a community now. And the last part of fit to me is a career service fit, that idea of not being apologetic about saying, am I going to get a great internship or a co-op or learning experience? And will that experience at that school, you know, loft me onto a job of substance upon graduation? And knowing that, John, as part of your college research,
right.
I mean, I could only have prayed that I would have wanted, I could have had that same conversation with my parents, you know, 30 years ago, but I didn't know, you know,
right.
Now I talk to students about teaching them that process, and that last part of career services, never feel like it's taboo to talk about. Are students getting jobs upon graduation? Are they getting great internships while they're in school? And then having the conversation from there.
Well, those are great pieces of advice. And you talk about fit, internship, research opportunities. I love that you added so many questions students to ask when you're on a tour, maybe of random students, in terms of whatever it is that's important to you, whether it's political views, whether it's clubs and organizations, whatever it is that's important to you. Because students, remember, there's over 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States alone. There is a school for everyone. Not every school, though, is necessarily for you. Just because mom and dad went to a school or your best friend is going to a school, you really got to see what the fit is for you. And I know that we have those lists. Rob, you know, you have great publications with some of the best colleges and universities in the country. But for example, if there's a school that's in the top 20, but it's in a rural environment, and you're a student that wants to be in the city in an urban environment, well, that school that's maybe number 15 on the list might not be for you. And it's the same thing. If you want to be in a rural environment, then you're not going to go to an urban environment, right? Do you want to be close to home, far from home? Do you want large, small? Again, students, finding that right fit for you, so important, so that you're going to be happy not only during your 4 years of college, but hopefully beyond if you continue with grad school. So we talked about financial fit a little bit as well, Rob.
Yeah.
So is college worth the investment, Rob?
Oh, God. I can never, you know, like, a, you know, I'm the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. I think, you know, my answer is going to be, but yeah, of course it's worth it. But the truth is, you know, like, and I'm asked this question, funny enough, John, I've been asked that question more over the last, I'm going to say, like, 5 years than over the last 25 years that I've been working at Princeton Review. So, and the truth is, college is worth it for any number of reasons, right? I think long quoted are these ideas of students who have a college degree will make, now it's up to $2.2 million more over their career lifetime than a student that doesn't have a college degree. But then there's other studies in addition to that, which I believe in full. Students that have a college degree report far, far lower percentages of unemployment throughout their career lifetime than a student without an undergraduate degree. They're more nimble in the professions and the regions and the globally, regionally as well, that students get to go into. Robert Wood Johnson did a study a few years back that said students that have a college degree will likely live longer than a student that doesn't have, because they will likely have better medical insurance throughout their career lifetime than a student that doesn't. So, and those are the four things that I often go to when asked this question, because to me, it resonates with students, no matter their age group, students, parents, and counselors. And it does, again, underscore the value of a college degree. And to me, it's just the best thing ever. And I don't tire, and I know you and I are the same, we don't tire talking about it. You know, it's infinitely definitely interesting.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, somebody once said, a very wise person, they said, yes, the cost of college is very expensive. What's even more expensive is perhaps not having an education at all. Oh, so, yeah. You know, you really can put value on, you know, a college education. And I love how you talked about, you know, there's a study that based on those people that have a college education, I guess because of health insurance and hopefully better jobs later on, that they actually live longer. That's something I didn't hear about, Rob, but I appreciate you sharing.
Wow. Awesome.
So, Rob, I was also curious, how is AI artificial intelligence being used in college admissions. And do you have any insight at all on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much chatter, obviously, no matter the business vertical that, you know, last year at this time, it would have been hard to have this conversation around AI because we didn't know where it was going to go. But the truth is, it's going everywhere, right? So you know, pick your vertical. But the truth is, admission is one of those verticals, right? And I will just say out loud, you know, we're doing a lot of AI stuff at Princeton Review. The one that I think is so interesting for our conversation is this idea of we have an AI resource that helps, you know, give you feedback on your college essay. So it is, within seconds, you're getting feedback on your essay. Certainly not rewriting your essay, because AI would also be able to identify the plagiarism in that. But being able to give you substantive content, as would any really good college counselor. And I love that stuff. So I think that, to answer your question, I think that there are verticals that are going, or products, pardon me, around admission, like essay review, like the scattergram on are you a Navion school? I'm sorry.
We're a Navion school, and the scattergram is amazing. I used it for both of my daughters.
And now think about adding AI to that. Well, now it's going to be, right, you know, that much more powerful. Now, whether you know, Navion is going to do that or not, but I'm just saying that those types of minutia of data points on products that we're using now is just going to be turned up to, you know, 11 on the ability for our students to be able to use them. But they're not using them singularly, right? These are family or community tools that we can use. And right, to me, that is of great value. There was a big article in the New York Times a couple of months ago talking about, you know, AI, and they had a lot of the NACAC, you know, regulars, many of whom I know have been on your shows. But they're like, listen, this is coming. We don't have the opportunity. We don't have the luxury to not talk about it, because that would be the death knell for us, right? We have to be able to discuss it with our students and put some margins in it for them, because they're going to use it anyway. Let's use it in a way that's substantive rather than cheating, which I think everybody goes to when thinking about AI.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And it reminds me when, I think it was back in 1998, when this thing called the Google search came out, and everyone was freaking out, like, oh my God, are people going to cheat? And I think, you know, here we are again with artificial intelligence. And I do think that college admissions reps, and we've talked about it in some of the episodes, I think they need to go a little bit more performance-based, probably be more personalized in terms of the essay prompts. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how AI changes the college application process as the years proceed. So Rob, I was also curious, how does the Princeton Review assist students in finding the right colleges for them? And what advice do you have for students in navigating the college selection process? I know you gave us a lot, but what more could you share with us?
Yeah, sure. Well, I do a couple. I still write a couple. Like, my big boy job is editor-in-chief, so I'm responsible across a lot of variables. I mean, a lot of verticals. But the truth is that, I mean, I still write some college guidebooks with a wonderful group of Princeton reviewers. But I think this idea, I write a book called The Best 389 Colleges, and it comes out every August, so it might be.
It's a great book. I love it. I have it.
Cool. That's great. Well, I really love the idea of asking current college students what their experiences are at their schools. And that idea of fit that we talked about before with those four different channels, that all comes from asking students, current college students, what their experiences are academically, campus culture, financial aid, career services, and many other things fit into those buckets because they're really big. But the truth is, that's the stuff. Like I say, I write this book with a team of folks, but the truth is, we're like channeling what we're hearing directly from. So this isn't my opinion. Like nobody should ever listen to me about what my opinion is of a particular school, but the truth is, I yield from an editorial perspective to what those current students are saying. Now, and I'm in a unique position at Princeton Review where we'll get thousands and thousands and thousands of surveys per school, depending on the size of the school. So I'm in a unique position to receive a lot of those things, synthesize them down to something that's valuable for a college-bound student and their parent and their counselor so that they can have a conversation of fit. But that, to me, it would be tragically flawed to me, John, if a student didn't have access to current college student opinion. And now the truth is that students have access to, if students are listening to us, you know, assignments, as much as I hate to give them out, but if you're not following schools on social, that are on your list or maybe prospective schools. I'm not just talking about the admission office either, right? Following student groups, you know, where you're now collecting primary source information from a school on a device, on a platform that you're going to certainly know how to work better than I ever will. And now you're using it to figure out substance and figuring out if that school is going to be a best fit for you based on that substance. So I think we're doing a really credible job there. But then I also think you got to cross that stream with your own stuff that you're collecting from student opinion too.
Well, I really appreciate that. And the best 389 colleges is definitely a great publication, particularly for a student that wants more information about a certain school. Obviously, there's 389 colleges in alphabetical order, and you get a lot of information, to your point, straight from college students, which I think is so helpful. We also talk about the importance of visiting colleges. And of course, you sign in at the admissions office. There's the tour with someone who's trained to give you the best tour and show you the best places. Students, you owe it to yourself. Take an hour on campus and ask a random student on campus whatever it is that you want to know about. Tell me about housing. Is housing guaranteed for 4 years? Tell me about the social life on the weekend. Is it a commuter school or do people stay? Tell me about the professor to student ratio. And by the way, does it change from freshman year through senior year? I'm just throwing some random questions out there. But the point is, and Rob, you made it very important to get insight, not from me, for example, that went to college many, many years ago, but if you could get on campus and talk directly with students that are there, I think it's great advice. And I love the work that you do with the Princeton Review, where you're surveying, like you said, in many cases, thousands of students, depending on the size of the school, and you're giving their voice to potential students that want to maybe go to that college one day. So we really appreciate that, Rob. And this has been a phenomenal conversation. Before I get to my last question, Rob,
is there
a question I didn't ask, or a topic that I didn't bring up today that you'd like to leave with us now?
No, I think that we hit on a great number of things. You know, when I think about, here's the thing, when I think about students going through the process, and as we talked about, you know, like students applying to 7 and 9 schools, I share with, you know, with many students that I talk to, the mistakes that I have seen my own students make. And I say this with great love. Them and their parents make these mistakes. But the truth is, and I'm sure this will never happen to any of your listeners, John, but applying to, let's say, applying to these, you know, 9 schools on your list, but applying to those schools because your boyfriend or girlfriend goes to that school. Yeah? Or applying to that school because everybody from my high school tends to apply to that school.
Right.
Or applying to that school because it's easy to get into. Mm. Or like the last thing, applying to school because it's hard to get into. You know, the truth is that, you know, you're doing such an awesome job. All of these interviews and all of this amazing brain trust of folks that you're bringing in here. And that 7 or 9 schools that students are applying to, they should all be, like, a student should be delighted to go to any one of them. Because as you said, there's 4,000 four-year colleges in the U.S. alone. We have the greatest luxury to be able to choose those 7 or 9 schools or whatever it is that we're applying to and truly be delighted to go to each of them and be able to articulate why. And to me, I think that's just the idea, just to tell students again, that would be my last point. That was a real soapbox answer, John. I'll shut up about that stuff
now. No, I think it's fantastic. And you mentioned students that apply to 7 to 9. And of course, there's many others that apply somewhere around the 15 range. And at the end of it all, Rob, you could only go to one, right? So it's important to do your research and, you know, certainly narrow it down and find that right fit. We spoke a lot about fit and so many other great things. And Rob, this has been amazing. It's such an honor to have you here. Unfortunately, it does lead us to the last question, which is, what are your top 3 pieces of advice for students and their families getting ready for the college admissions process?
Oh, gosh. To me, this process is a joy. You know, it should never be a burden. And it can be challenging. I totally understand that. But if I'm giving one piece of advice to students and parents, I'm like, this is a joyful process. And to get it working for you, to embrace, to literally bear hug the things that we were discussing today, you know, poke at taboos. As you said, talk to students, gather as much of that student information as possible. Because this, you know, people are going to ask you where you went to college literally for the rest of your life. Be able to make a confident and a clear decision based on your idea of fit. To me, that's the best advice that I could ever give to a student. And I mean it right down to my toes. I mean, this is the stuff I live every day. And I know we're both the same in that regard.
Well, those are great pieces of advice, Rob. And like I said earlier, the Princeton Review is so lucky to have you, as were we, on this conversation. And I'm really so happy, number one, because we met and you're just awesome, but also because I know that this conversation is going to help so many students and their parents as they navigate this process. So I do hope to have you again, Rob. You were awesome. Thank you so much.
Oh, pleasure, my friend. Thank you. Be well.
Be well. And to everyone out there, good luck with the college search. Take care, everyone. Best wishes. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The CAP, the College Admissions Process Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please don't forget to tell a friend and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and wherever you listen to your podcasts. I am your host, John Durante, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of The CAP. Thank you for listening to the College Admissions Process Podcast presented by Prep Expert. Prep Expert offers live online SAT and ACT courses with the best score guarantees, instructors, and curriculum. Go to prepexpert.com to guarantee your child's success.